And filling in for Evan today and the rest of the week and next week is me, Tamara Cherry, coming at you live from Regina, Saskatchewan. And it is Wednesday. You know what that means? It's time for the War Room.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear them.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here.
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The War Room.
Of course, this is the time of the week that we convene some of the best political thinkers and commentators in the country to discuss the big political stories of the week. Joining us today are Tim Powers, chairman of Summa Strategies and managing director of Abacus Data, Lindsay Maskell, political consultant and former advisor to Premier Dalton McGuinty, and David Mosscrop, a columnist for the Washington Post and author of Too Dumb for Democracy. Welcome, everybody.
Hey, Tamara.
Good afternoon.
David, did I say your last name right? I was just telling our technical producer, I read you all the time, but I don't remember hearing your name spoken out loud. Is it Mosscrop?
It's the post-truth era, so it doesn't really matter. You can say, oh, that is strictly speaking correct, but it doesn't matter. It's whatever you want. It doesn't even matter.
It matters, David. We're all snowflakes and we all care. So let's just make sure we're pronouncing everybody's names right. All right, well, let's get started. Okay, good. Okay, so there is a debate happening tonight. Some people may be very well aware of this. Some people maybe not at all. And that's because only three out of the five conservative candidates vying for leadership in that party are going to be appearing in tonight's debate. Those will be ex-Quebec Premier Jean Charest, rural Ontario MP Scott Aitchison, and Roman Baber, former provincial legislator who Doug Ford booted from caucus over his opposition to COVID-19 lockdowns. Tim Powers. Do you care? Do you care about this debate tonight? Will you be watching it?
Oh, tomorrow I'm going to be carving a watermelon, finding a new Riders jersey, and getting ready to go to Mosaic Field to watch your team play. I care more about that, but I have to watch the debate tonight, so it's like a sentence I've agreed to serve for 75 minutes. My overwhelming sarcasm aside, there will be Conservative Party members who care about this. There will be Canadians outside the Conservative Party who will care about this. I mean, clearly Pierre Poilievre and Leslyn Lewis don't care about this. They're going to write $50,000 checks each not to go there. I think that's a bit arrogant on their behalf, but they're both confident in their own way that they don't need to be there. For the three that are there, it's a bit of an opportunity, but, you know, it's an opportunity to move up to number 45 on the Netflix show list you haven't watched yet.
Lindsay Maskell, who do you think will be caring tonight? Tim just mentioned there are some conservatives, other people who will be interested. Who do you think is going to be watching tonight?
Well, those that are concerned, I mean, look, they did survey the party members and they wanted this debate. So there are pre-existing, probably more centrist and progressive conservatives that are concerned that they're not participating in the process and just see this as no upside for them, with the fact that they could be on the attack or, you know, the chance of making a mistake, considering that we've all seen lots of this debate content, and especially when it has so much pandering a bit more to the far right of content that comes out during a general election, right? So why I'm sure that it was worth a $50,000 check to avoid another bad debate performance that results in being some fun content for your opposition during the general election.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, you know, Tim, you said you wanted to watch the Rider game tonight. Pierre Poilievre is not going to be in tonight's debate, but he is in Saskatchewan, so perhaps he will be as well. David, do you think that this debate matters when the clear front runner is not going to be a part of it?
Well, I guess let's try a thought experiment. You know, imagine you're watching the NHL playoffs and they decide to hold a playoff game after a team has won the Stanley Cup. I guess the question would be, would that game matter?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is no. But I guess, you know, or you could say, look, it's the bronze medal game. People watch the bronze medal hockey game, right? So there must be some interest. But I do think if it's
people
anything...
People who really love medals, hockey.
Yeah, who really love hockey. Or maybe, you know, sometimes the bronze medal is great news for a country. It's a great showing for some countries. And I suspect that this is sort of like a bronze medal game. You know, after seeing the fundraising numbers and the membership numbers from the Poilievre campaign, I was just writing about this morning. It seems to be a done deal. And so watching this is a lot like, you know, the bronze medal game. But hey, sometimes those are great games.
So David, let's pick up on that. You know, we're going to be, the winner's going to be announced September 10th for this leadership race, but I was really interested reading the Toronto Star story about the amount of money that Pierre Poilievre has managed to raise. I believe it was $4 million, and that's more than any conservative candidate in recent history. Second up was Charest, who brought in almost $1.4 million, nobody else trailing anywhere closely behind that. David, just given that you said you were writing about this morning, what do you think that says about this conservative leadership race and the I guess, the sentiments that Pierre Poilievre has been tapping into?
Well, as you mentioned, he raised an awful lot of money. In fact, raised more than all of his competitors combined. And it wasn't a handful of donations. He did it over an extraordinary number of donations, too. So it's not just big donors donating. It's a lot of people giving him a lot of money. And so it's obviously it's resonating. So I've been saying this for months. He's tapped into an anger and frustration and anxiety that has been sort of percolating for a long time in the Canadian public. And he's tapped into it, and he's mobilizing these folks, and it's working extraordinarily well. And you've got to give him credit for that and give his campaign credit for that, even though, and this is a huge addendum, I think he's writing checks his butt can't cash. So eventually you've got to try to pay the price for that. I don't think he can. So I think in the long run, this is going to lead to a lot of trouble for him. But in the short run, for winning the leadership, which is the goal right now, I think it's working extraordinarily well.
Do you think, though, Lindsay, I'll put this to you. Do you think that this will lead to a lot of trouble for Poilievre down the road, or could it lead to a lot of trouble for all the people that have been donating to him? Do you think that he'll care? Like, I sort of liken this to the support that President Trump, before he was president, garnered before he was running for presidency, and now again, as he seems poised to do again. Lindsay, do you think that Poilievre will suffer down the road?
So when I look at fundraising, I kind of do think a bit bigger picture, in the sense that, you know, in the last two elections, the Conservatives actually out-fundraised the Liberals in both elections. So it is not, this being news doesn't feel like news to me, in the sense that it sort of does feel like status quo. And they are just trying to write the story that this is an inevitable result of Pierre being the winner based on fundraising numbers. And that may be true within their party, but that has not been true for many elections in Canadian general elections. But I will say that there is an issue that when he is definitely tapping into, as David said, the anger and fear that some people are feeling, that also drove a lot of fundraising to causes like the convoy, that, you know, those people expect a result for that investment in the person who they think is leading their charge. So you can raise a lot of expectations and disappoint a lot of people. So, but it does not always take the most amount of money to win a campaign, as we can see in every general election that we've had in the last couple of years, where the Conservatives have out-fundraised the Liberals.
Tim Powers, we have just a little bit more than a minute left. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm still carving the watermelon here, because that's going to be more exciting. He's a cash machine, right? He targets audiences exceptionally well, but he's going to there will be a reckoning at some point, because his appeals that work now to get cash and to get support are based on anger. They're based on fear. That's probably going to continue, yes, for a little while, but if he wants to win the rest of the country, he's going to have to broaden his game plan. So good for him now, and I'm sure he's thinking about that should he be the winner come September 10th.
You think that he will switch strategies, like when it comes time to going up against Trudeau, really quickly, Tim?
I don't know if he'll switch strategies, but he's going to have to think about approach, and there's a difference between an approach and a strategy. Can Pierre do that? We'll see. He likes to have tinfoil on his knuckles all the time. Sometimes the tinfoil wilts and the knuckles get bloody and you don't get what you want.
Tinfoil on Pierre Poilievre's knuckles, watermelon, sticky watermelon on your head. That was Tim Powers, from chairman of Summa Strategies, you're just listening to there. We also got Lindsay Maskell, political consultant and former advisor to Premier Dalton McGuinty, and David Moskrop, from what I understand is how we pronounce it, columnist for the Washington Post and author of Too Dumb for Democracy. You are listening to The War Room on The Evan Solomon Show. I am Tamara Cherry, filling in for Evan. We've got a lot coming up from our panel after the break. And filling in for Evan is me, Tamara Cherry, in Regina, Saskatchewan. but not just me, because it is Wednesday, and that means it is time for the War Room. We're into our second segment, in which we convene some of the greatest minds from across the country, greatest political minds in particular. Today, joining us, Tim Powers, Chairman of SUMA Strategies and Managing Director of Abacus Data, Lindsay Maskell, political consultant and former advisor to Premier Dalton McGuinty, and David Moskrop, columnist for The Washington Post and author of Too Dumb for Democracy. Speaking of Saskatchewan, Saskatchewan has been under strain, our healthcare system, as many healthcare systems have across the country, including Ontario. Well, Ontario's health minister broke weeks of silence on Tuesday afternoon to address growing hospital emergency room and intensive care unit closures. She spoke with CP24 in Toronto yesterday.
It's always a very challenging decision when they have to shut down an emergency department, whether it's for 4 hours, one shift, or in some cases over the weekend. I know that it is very challenging for them to do this and make those determinations.
She went on to say this.
However, I want to reassure people that Ontario Health is a major part of the plan to work with those local hospitals to make sure that they have the capacity, and all of the options have been put on the table.
Well, Jones called the closure of emergency departments very disturbing. She said the province has done a lot to address the issue. As proof, she pointed to the province's ongoing work with partnering health organizations. I'm going to start with you on this one, Lindsay Maskell, given your former advisor to Premier Dalton McGuinty in Ontario. I mean, this is an issue that we're hearing a lot about now, but we heard a lot about during the pandemic, and we've heard a lot about it in, you know, for years, decades before the pandemic. Do you think that this is coming to a head politically for the Ontario government? Will they pay a price for this, this newly, well, re-elected government?
Well, it's an interesting challenge, and you know, it's a fair point, Mara. I sort of felt like we were there before with emergency room closures. I remember having a cabinet minister's wife who was a doctor staffing an emergency room during an election to try to keep one open. And it was just, you know, distressing to communities when this happens. And it did happen. It has happened many times before. But one of the things that we looked at was, you know, what is a strategy that deals with what's clogging up emergency rooms and having us, you know, a plan around cancer, heart, hip, knee surgeries, things like that that are clogging up emergency rooms. And, you know, this is a very different case because, of course, we have a significant human resource challenge right now that we're dealing with. But you have more than 1 million Ontarians waiting in surgical backlog, and that is definitely causing a boiling pot for the Minister of Health. It's also a PR issue in the sense that we're used to, through this pandemic and just through an election, of the government and elected officials being very available to us and being accountable. So I know she was just recently sworn in as the minister, but she was also standing next to Christine Elliott through many press conferences. So it raised the temperature a lot that we weren't hearing about what's the plan to start to make real changes that are going to be customer service based, that are going to help us get through the backlog. And people are very sympathetic to the strain on our healthcare professionals through this pandemic. So it's definitely a boiling point issue, and it's about to come to a head, I'm sure.
Tim Powers, CP24, they point out that while Jones has made several public appearances since she was appointed to her new role at the end of June, up until this point, she has not addressed the staffing crisis that has led to dozens of hospital closures. What do you make of her finally coming out and speaking on this issue now? And were her words sufficient?
Are any words from any politician right now sufficient? Does anybody believe them? Lindsay touched on, I think, what is the key issue tomorrow. And until we're ready to talk about how systems all across the country need to be rejigged and need to deal with the realities of systems and manage people's expectations, anything we hear is just claptrap from any politician. And, you know, it's all about get the big check from Ottawa. Well, my goodness, it's sure of a hell of a lot more than that. And we're equally culpable in all of this. We have to understand, as citizens of Ontario, Newfoundland, and Labrador, Saskatchewan, where have it, that, you know, the system as it has operated for decades needs to change and needs to transform. we don't push politicians hard enough on that. We like when they deliver money for us. We like when things seem to work, but we've had proof for decades now that we need overall system change. So great for Sylvie Jones to show up, but she's not adding anything substantive to the debate that's going to make a meaningful difference.
David Moskrop, I mean, as somebody who writes a column for the Washington Post on the other side of the border, what do you make of how this conversation plays out in Canada? Because we've got very different healthcare systems in the two countries.
I mean, I think it is a universal law of Canadian politics that politicians are given more credit, and the country's given more credit than it's often due because we are next door to the United States. And it's easy to say, well, look, I mean, we've got our problems, but we're not the United States. Well, the fact is that for millions of Americans, their system works extraordinarily well. It works extraordinarily poorly for millions, too. But for those for whom it works very, very well. In this country, if you're trying to get into an emergency room, there's a very good chance that it works poorly for you, no matter who you are. So the question is, how do we make sure that it works well for everyone, no matter who you are? And again, I to echo Tim's point, that's not a discussion we're even having. We sort of skate by it, but we certainly need to. But I will mention this. The labor side deserves a close look, too. Mm-hmm. The question of, you know, who's staffing these places, who's not, and why are they leaving? And the fact is that folks have been underpaid in that, especially nurses in the healthcare system and support staff for a very long time. They've been treated remarkably poorly. They haven't been given the support. So no wonder they're leaving, and we're left with a human resources catastrophe. But it's not just the pandemic. It's been a long time coming.
Well, exactly. And certainly the pandemic has caused it to reach new heights. I mean, there's reduced staffing, there's low morale, there's overburdened emergency rooms right now. A couple weeks ago on this very show, I was speaking with a doctor at the Children's Hospital in Montreal who was saying that they were at 193%, something around their capacity, because all these kids are becoming sick, I guess perhaps because they've had such little contact with people over the last couple years. So if this isn't the boiling point that is going to make us, you know, leap into those serious conversations, Tim, what do you think would get us to that point?
I think it's going to be sadly more tragedies and people hearing about the tragedies and the burnout that David talked about. Look, here's a great example right now, Tamara. In Newfoundland and Labrador, as in most of the rest of the country, we have wonderful refugees coming to Canada from the Ukraine. I know the story of a doctor in Ukraine. I was doing a talk show like you are. She called in. She said, I've been medically trained. 8 years I've worked in the field. If I want to practice in Newfoundland and Labrador that has a rural healthcare problem, can't get doctors, Fogo Island, perhaps the most infamous of all of that, she's got to wait 2 to 5 years. That credentialing issue, as Lindsay knows, as David knows, has been a problem in this country for over a decade. You know, so if you can't get medical care in communities like that and you can solve it with credentialing, why don't you get to solving it? Because sadly, it's going to be deaths. It's going to be shortages. It's going to be these things that force people to say, all right, we can't have it the way Tommy Douglas envisioned it. We better find out a way to make it work now.
Lindsay, do you see this moving into more of a federal conversation, because healthcare is a provincial issue? It's easy to have these segmented conversations about Ontario or Saskatchewan or wherever else, Quebec, that's having these problems. But do you see this inching towards more of a federal topic of discussion?
Well, I'd love to see it move more than just a yearly ask of, you know, money and the feds say, like, you know, give us a plan. Things do need to change, right? And I think one of the things that would make a big difference is really just the innovation. I use a very simple analogy of, you know, I come from a very typical Ontario family right now. My father is waiting for cardiac surgery, and I am waiting for ankle surgery to have a plate removed from my ankle. If you are like us, you are chasing the medical system, calling your doctor, trying to schedule. Yet we know, via, you know, technology like the bike system or Uber, where a million cars are at any point in time, but you don't know where you are in the healthcare system. So there would be some really interesting innovations and ideas that may cost a lot of money, but would actually move yardsticks in terms of some progress.
Bring us into the 21st century. Lindsay, I'm sorry, we've got to end it there. Tim Powers, Lindsay Maskell, David Moskrop, thanks for joining us in the War Room. Stay tuned for a conversation you won't want to miss coming up after the break.